The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Joining me on the telephone on Staten Island is the author Ben Miller. He's got a new book out. It's his first novel that I'm aware of. It's called The Parade. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Oh, great to be here, Vic. Just wonderful. And it's an honor to have the first public dialogue about The Parade with you.
Ben, is this your first novel?
Well, it's the first published novel.
Okay, well then.
I'll say that.
So you've got a bunch in the drawer just sitting there?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think development too. I mean, this book had an enormously long development period of time. So a lot of times I'll do a draft and then return to a book, and I like to really work on things for an arc of time. So okay. There are others. I hope to get others out there.
Well, you mentioned in some of our messaging something about 38 years. What does that represent?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, this is probably the most interesting thing about the book. I mean, at least, you know, in one way. The first draft was completed in the spring of 1987. And counted that way, the novel has about a 39-year gestation. But actually, the first fragments of the book were written in 1980, which makes it about 46 years to completion, which... I don't think I have the option to do that again, but it certainly has given me an artistic experience like no other, really, I'll ever have in my life.
You were already thinking about this kind of stuff all those years ago, Ben. Here I'm reading it. I'm going, oh, he's obviously influenced by the current events in the world. But holy smokes, you were on to this story a long time ago. And I do want to tell listeners, this is fiction. And we're not talking about you. We're not talking about anything you believe in or the world you live in. This is pure fiction, right, Ben?
Exactly. Yep. And I think, you know, the book began in 1987. I just come to New York City, and I had no credit card, no phone, no health insurance. And I thought of myself as a writer, but not only did I not have a computer, I didn't even have a typewriter. So I had... become this idea of being a writer just with pen and paper. But I got to New York, and I just didn't think that not having all that apparatus would stop me from being a writer. So, because I lived with that for a long time without having some of those things. So I rented a time on a typewriter at NYU to begin the book. And basically, it's sort of, the book really is about an ordeal of identity. I mean, for the community where it takes place and also the main character. And in a very interesting way, it's probably the most starkly autobiographical work I've done, even though it's fiction. It really lays bare the mechanics of family dissolution on one level and the grotesque results of that. So my story as a youth, which was really in part told in my first book, the nonfiction work Riverbend Chronicle, is sort of the story of a family that's fleeing from family, you know, shattering, breaking into smaller and smaller parts to evade a kind of damning hole of disappointment and trouble, but in doing so, sort of getting into even more trouble. And so I was sort of living with that, having just left the Midwest, and it was all upon me, looking back there, beginning to dawn on me what had happened. So the book, you know, became sort of like a sort of a, in the beginning, like a metaphor for my own sense of disorientation in a slew of questions about why things happened the way they did when I was a young person and why there was no parents around and why I was on the streets and things like that. And that kind of over time started to connect to the whole, you know, identity crisis that America has, you know, always, you know, due to geography, due to tensions between factions in America. And really Tocqueville was onto that from the start. I mean, in Democracy of America, you have the sense of Americans as individuals, but yet counterbalancing that is this sort of fad, tendency to fads and mob behavior. And they've been at war ever since. They're at war now, that thing of the individual and group behavior. And I think at the core of the book, that's what it's about on the different levels, the social level, the personal level, and I would even say the spiritual level.
The book is The Parade. Ben Miller joins us. Were you searching for your mother?
I would say I was grieving the loss of really never having had a mother when I got to New York because of certain things that had happened and the family shattering. So I think I was thinking, like, I've got somehow gotten to this little cliff, like half of a studio apartment in New York City. And I was clinging to it like a fledgling who didn't really know how to fly. And there was no one really want to teach me to fly, except sort of my, I mean, art had always been something that buoyed me up. And so I really think that, like, thinking about, you know, who my mother could have been if I had gotten to know her, why were we separated, really, in a sense, emotionally, you know, intellectually and spiritually, just by her mental illness in one way, but also the way she had been treated by society as a young woman who had had ambitions to do a lot in the world. And right about the time she had children, it was all falling apart, and she was falling apart. So I think the beginning, you know, was always like, wow, I had gone through this American experience that wasn't like other American experiences that people were promoting. And yet it was real, and it made me who I was. And I had never been in jail. I had never tried to kill myself. I mean, I somehow held it together through all that stuff. I didn't have an addiction, but I was trying to figure out, like, what were you, you know, what was there left to hold on to? What in America that had really sort of, in a sense, not been there for this kid, what was there to look at and study and figure out, well, why was I told by my high school counselor not to go to college? Why, when I went to school as about weighing about 100 pounds and skeletal, no one called social services? I mean, you know, it was just one of those crazy things where none of the American nets worked. Mm. And then what was that about? What was that about? Was it about conformity? Was it about terror, of other people's terror of what they might confront, et cetera? So yes, I mean, I think that's a key question that you bring up. I mean, about, you know, the family connection that is sort of severed by this scheme that they have in this community to constantly celebrate things and yet not face things.
You're listening to The Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. I've been joined on the telephone by Ben Miller. His new novel is The Parade. And this is quite a read, Ben. I know you, and I've read your other work, and it's really different. And I think for some readers, it might be almost impenetrable because of the style that you have, because it's just so quick, and there's just so much going on. And what do you think, Ben? I mean, what do you say to a reader who's reading this and they're like going, it's like gobbledygook?
Well, you know, I mean, I've always been fascinated by mess. You know, the mess of the world, the mess inside, the mess outside. And my first book, Riverbend Chronicle, had no paragraphs, and it was 458 pages long. It had instead those text blocks that flowed. And I think that was the beginning of my real, you know, real theme of trying to deal with the mess, you know, of, you know, internal, socially, et cetera. And so I think that, you know, that's coupled sort of with the idea, I mean, how do you study the mess if you don't make a mess? You know, I mean, I think I see writing about things from a distance, but I don't like that type of writing so much. I feel much more akin to being inside the experience or somehow speaking from inside it when I'm pressured by it. And I think that there are those two different artistic ways. And I think there's really, in a sense, in a way, fiction should be more messy in some ways, as nonfiction, to reflect things and not distill it all to one typical story and tell it and all sounds crisp and it all sounds controllable. And then we walk around in the world and see what we see, which is not bad at all. It's totally out of control. But I would say that there is sort of an aesthetic idea that I've always loved, is I love books that are made of books, sort of that have various books embedded inside each other, sort of like a Chinese box. And I think that, you know, that concept of different stratas, you know, building up, and the concept of layering is really, really important. And my dream would be that people would first just hear, well, there's some hearing something in the distance, like a new music that I haven't heard, and they would walk closer to it, a little closer, and hear it more distinctly. And then they would start to pick out what they relate to. Is it the congas? Is it the flute? Is it some combination of duo instruments? And then walk toward that. Pick their own book out of the swirling symphony of what I've tried to create. And there's no question that it swirls. There's no question that it turns and pivots completely all the time. But that's also been my experience of life in America. Continual, huge pivots. Got money today, don't have money tomorrow. Car works today, car doesn't work tomorrow. You know, someone was supposed to be here to pick me up 10 minutes ago, and it's 8 hours later. You find yourself in this crowded country in the most desolate positions, on top of a bridge, let's say, over the Mississippi River, the Centennial Bridge, and there's no one within a mile. Mm-hmm. And yet, the city has 250,000 people there. So this sort of the tension of that has always been so inbred, and I've tried to follow it. And I said, well, that's just it. I have to pivot like this life pivots, and I think I want my work to reflect my life. I just don't see it as something that's separate. It is deeply embedded in, at first it was embedded in survival as a kid when I thought, wow, art, I can do whatever I want. I have control here. It's the one area. And I think that I've really treasured that autonomy, but also too, with that comes the responsibility that you need to take for that autonomy. And I think that's really important. So I'm totally responsible if you throw the book out the window. And what I would hope is you would throw it out the window and then 10 minutes later go out and retrieve it.
Hallelujah, brother. My guest is Ben Miller. We're talking about his novel, The Parade. You talked about hearing those instruments and focusing on one. I kept hearing a kazoo out there when I was reading your book. And I also kept getting flashes of James Joyce. And you have offered to read from the book, and we need to take a quick break, and then we'll bring you back, and you can let listeners hear your voice interpreting your work on the radio. Does that sound good?
That sounds wonderful.
All right. You're listening to the Book Nook, and we'll continue with Ben Miller, but first, this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I've been joined on the telephone on Staten Island by Ben Miller. His new novel is called The Parade. And Ben, we're starting to get some smoke down here in southwest Ohio from these wildfires up north. I understand out in New York you're getting a lot of smoke. And one of the messages that I got from your book is about the environment. And if you were working on this book back in the 1980s, apparently you were already tuned into the situation. There's definitely a message here about the environment.
Yes. I mean, I think I grew up on the Mississippi River in urban Iowa, and it was nothing like the bucolic area that people in other parts of the country might think. I mean, they might think corn, they might think cows that are standing upright and healthy. Basically, in Davenport, Iowa, or the Quad Cities, an area of about 250,000 people, there was rust, there were PCBs in the Mississippi River due to dumping by factories farther upriver near Dubuque. And so there was this sense of this brown heart of the community churning with all of these chemicals that were poisoning the fish and made them impossible to eat for the people who were trying to catch them. So, and I think that, too, there was a word in the 1970s and 80s that was used a lot. It was smog. And there was a smog dome over Davenport due to the factories. And I had a wonderful teacher named Mr. Miller in junior high. And he was the first person I ever knew use the word recycling. He was the first person who I ever knew talk about ozone. And although he was in this really urban school and not people were throwing spitballs at him and everything, he just really was focused on the fact that we were in an ecological peril at that time. And when I looked around, I saw what he was talking about. The sky was green some days, and people were just throwing cans all over the place, and that was material that could have been reused. So, yes, and that's sort of been with me as I came to the East Coast. I saw the East Coast version when I first came to New York City. You were allowed they had these burners in buildings, and you just dumped your trash into like a hole and incinerator, and it went down and it burned, and then a little tendril of black smoke would come up out of the building. and you could smell it. And, you know, so there's all in different ways, I think, the disuse of the environment has been part of my life, like most people's lives, if they really looked around and smelled and tasted.
I remember those incinerators. We used to have some apartments that had them on my paper route, and in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, we'd be delivering the paper, and we'd toss a string of black cats down the incinerator and then just run. In sixth grade, I had a teacher named Nan Tiernan, and one day she took me in the corner, and she pulled a book off the bookshelf. It was one of those Time Life books, and she said, look at this word. Look at the title of this book. She said, this is going to be a very important word as you get older. And the name of the book was Ecology. And I had never heard the word before. Ben, you mentioned that you'd like to read an excerpt from The Parade. And I'm wondering if this is a good time to do that.
Oh yeah. Well, I would love to do that. And I've never actually read from it in public or anything. This is all new to me. And, you know, having worked on it for so long, I mean, this is like a big, wonderful chance to share some of the material in the beginning of the book. I'm just going to start where it begins and go for a little bit in. So you don't really need to, reader doesn't need to know anything too much. And let's do it. Chapter 1. Lines of marchers were reassembling in the middle of the street when the marshal came for me in Spectator House. "You're late again, Tobe. The parade awaits. Get up, get up," he cried. I had heard the thin warble of dawn bugles, the congestion of motorcade engines, and antic talk of other kids as they tugged on glad rags. "I can flew faster than you. The dream float is my favorite." But I didn't fake a smile. I wanted to miss out. He snatched the spangled pillow from under my head and threw it out the broken bunk room window. "Life is a celebration," he cried. "Rise and shout for joy." I retreated under the new glory flag we were required to wrap ourselves in every night at bedtime. It featured gray and grayer horizontal stripes, bisected by diagonal purple stripes the Grand Marshal had recently ordered the sewers to add, a flag of X's. Emily, the confetti cutter, laughed at the ploy. "That GM can't fix one mistake, let alone 1,000 wrong turns." In one flag corner existed a block of very black pimpled fabric. Each of the stars represented a parade float. The marshal peeled the flag off me and leaned too close. Binoculars around his neck rested on my chest, as if peering into far places in my heart. I could smell his cherry cologne, feel the unhealthy heat of his heavy uniform. "Give me 4 cheers. Give me 5. You're proud. I'm proud. We are all proud to be living at the greatest time in the greatest place on the greatest planet." He could pretend to know this, but the poor marshal, he did not even know what year it was. Each time I asked, he answered differently. Sometimes it was 1985. Sometimes it was 1908 or 2024, even 1828. His cap resembled a stricken box turtle. Icky epaulettes safety pinned to soiled sides of the brass button coat, missing 2 buttons. Peeling patent leather belt. Formerly white bars trailed down the side of faded blue pants to scuffed black pointy bootlets. "Get with it, boy, old boy. Grind out a grin. You've got a quota of 386 today, and what does your grinometer read? Up, up, pup, up. 0, 0. Stiltwalkers and patriots await. Up." Just 7 in the morning, and already his fresh pair of white padded gloves were suffering from the clapping required to chase the other boyo boys out the door. "I'm sick of it," I muttered. His bloodshot eyes blinked. "Sick of streamers, candy, jugglers? Impossible! You are the very age of envy." "Can't I skip today?" "What is skip?" "I can't stand the noise. It's not true." "Not true? What does truth have to do with anything? Whether you know it or not, you've only just begun to taste the glee of your inheritance. Soon you'll reach marching age and make the big stage. Join the best band in the land. Be part of the sound that goes round and round and round." "I'm not sure." "Leave the sureness to me." "I'm still not sure." A greasy grin fattened his gaunt face. He oiled his yapper to keep it operating during long days of mandatory joy. A tiny oil can dangled off his neck on a chain. Where's your euphoria, Bone? We, are we not? All or none, and none for all. You used to be crap happy when you were a scant baton, saluted every fly you saw, giggled when Nurse Monotone dropped you into the flag hamper and twirled you around in her mean way. You constructed fabulous float garnishings out of snot and wire and the last of the pine cone. On firework night, the fourth of every month, when I lit the fuse on the flumy, flying, woomer, bob, ting-topping, wig-bang, bloom-blang, drong, uh-oh, an attack of the blathers he had. So caught up in selling, he had no idea what he was selling. Flam, whistle, flim, flog, smog, hog, sparking, spank, uh-oh. He looked as happy, as helpless as I felt. Oil trickled off his rigid, industrial smile, staining his collar. He wasn't cruel like Monotone. Doing a job that made no sense naturally confused him. Scuttle, buttle, puddle, deducto, uh-oh. What a job, being crazy happy, no matter how he really felt. He awakened long before dawn to change flag diapers in the Spectator House nursery and scrub pigeon poop off megaphones and iron wrinkled bunting and tape together busted pennant sticks and unclog whirligigs and insert rose-colored lenses into Spectator binocs. Then he must inflate gray-striped balloons, shovel red confetti into starry lunch bags, and sharpen the tarnished confetti cleavers with the Plymouth Stone before scraping confetti cutting blocks clean and arranging the crowd on the curb to watch the parade go by. A headache, is it? He asked me. I nodded. Take this. He tossed a 3-inch plaid clown pill onto the bed. This drug made a nose feel rounder and feet feel longer. Neck hurt from craning to admire float pyrotechnics? Slip on this. A suspect rubber brace landed on the pill. Where did he pull it from? I did not see. Throat hurt from chanting? A dab of tonsil tonic will do it. A glass dropper bottle landed atop the brace. Ticker tape in the lungs? Crypto bits? Cough it up. Out of a sleeve, he yanked a multicolored string of world-weary hankies, as Emily called them, the hankies he cleaned megaphones with. Get out there, Tove. I know you can. And once you see the parade turn the corner, I'll bet a squadron of P-72s you'll forget you ever were sick. I doubt it. We are living the dream. If it's a dream, it's a dead one. Dead to me, anyway. Epaulettes trembled. He sat on the bed. Boy, oh boy, even geezers on the golden years convalescent float. Don't quit like this. I don't care, I said. Why, we've perfected the spit. I'm the spirit of the nation like the others haven't. If you don't take part in the story of the glory, what else are you going to do with your life? I'll lie here until I die, I told him. How's that?
Ben Miller. Reading from his new novel, The Parade, that's the opening. And Tove doesn't want to participate. He's your protagonist, and he sounds kind of depressed. And this is quite a world. Nurse Monotone, you mentioned, she's a very important figure in all this. Also another character called the Grand Marshal, who kind of reminded me a little bit of Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's sort of like the, I mean, America has this interesting skill at producing these fantastical characters. I mean, Buffalo Bill, P.T. Barnum, Houdini, and then there's the whole corollary in fiction and films of characters that have these kind of very amorphous themselves, sometimes even amorphous surfaces like the Grand Marshal. And, you know, they sort of shapeshift to maintain power and to do what they want to do. One of the key aspects of the book really is this sense of, you know, when realities crumble, you know, senses fail. And when the senses fail, myths take over. And the Grand Marshal is the arranger of the myth and is a propagator of the myths, and himself, because of that, is a kind of myth. And so, in a sense, he's a projection of all the needs and wants of the people that need those myths, as well as being, for a time, an actual figure.
Hmm. And when you mentioned crypto at that in that first part there, that kind of threw me because I thought, well, he must have written this recently. And,
Oh, sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's funny because I went through so many layers of writing. I would say I wrote the book probably, I mean, every 6 or 7 years. I mean, the main thing was people say, well, how could you take that out of a drawer and rewrite it so many times? I never took it out of the drawer. It was always open inside me. It was always growing. And its attachment to me, you know, was just ongoing. The characters never gave up on me. I never gave up on them. And even to the last, in the last 5 months, I mean, I had 42 pages of corrections that went to my wonderful publisher, April Gloaming, and who followed, you know, and helped me, you know, implement all of those corrections. So up to the very end, America was seeping into this, or it was communicating with elements in America. And that was obviously one of the things that came recently. But the actually the beginning and I Want to Miss Out, that's all exactly as it was in the beginning. And I think that was the key. You mentioned depression, you know, before, I think, which is probably as common in America as sunburns. You know, I mean, I think that was the key linchpin, the emotional linchpin of the book. I suddenly reached a point in life where I'd always thought a smile could win the day. I'd always thought effort could win the day. And yet it did not win the day. And the chaos I saw around me and in me, whatever it was, and I sort of wanted a break. And I think that this child's brave, you know, to say, I just can't smile anymore. This is fake. It's not real. And I don't really care what the price is because I can't go on living a non-life. And I want a life. And I think that sometimes not only is doing something a really affirmative thing, but also not doing something. And certainly you saw that with the civil rights movement, you know, as just not participating in these things anymore and enabling them really helped in some ways change things a little bit. But I think that that whole, yeah, that whole point of just constantly the book always being open. And I think in the end, there was that element of America being so open-ended. But also there was just this linguistic thing that I thought, always thought there was a sentence-by-sentence music that needed to be perfected to capture the turbulence of America, and meaning its conundrums, contradictions, outrages, yearnings, you know, harshnesses, and tenderness. And I felt there needed to be a powerful language to capture the sound of some of that. And, you know, there's the blaring in the book of the people like the Marshal who are just trying to make this dead parade live, which is sort of like, you know, doing an EMT, you know, doing CPR on a patient as it's not coming back. And then there's also people who say secret things to themselves like, it's windy and I like the wind feels nice on my face. Or I'm just going to stand here and look out and do small things that, in a sense, are revolutionary in their own small way.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Ben Miller. We're talking about his new novel, The Parade. And we need to take another quick break. And I noticed that there isn't a disclaimer in here saying that any similarities or resemblances to anything real is purely coincidental. So with that in mind, I want to read a really quick thing from near the end of the book that really resonated with me. You wrote, "It was as if each of the million lies had to die its own peculiar death to make enough room for truth to live. The empire that had bred so much powerlessness must die with the same ferocity that had given birth to its terror, its crimes, its emptiness." You're listening to The Book Nook. We'll be right back with Ben Miller right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I've been joined by Ben Miller. He's on Staten Island, and we're talking about his new novel, The Parade. Ben, tell us about the looters. Who are these people?
Well, that was an interesting thing that was always in the book from the very beginning, was that the fact that this town that has decided to go, and the simplest way to explain the book is that a town decides to step off the curb en masse and just march in circles and have a parade that never ends. So the town is abandoned then. The town that's on the other side of the curb, beyond the sidewalks, is abandoned by its residents because they've gotten so unhappy with it and they've been made so sad by the town. So what happens is that the parade goes around and they want that town to go away. So when looters start to come to take away belongings that have been left behind, you know, in houses and even the houses themselves, they are fine with that. They want a blank tableau. They want to start over. But the looters are one of the most fascinating elements of the book, and they really came really quick in the sense because, you know, part of my experience was that when we have a disaster, often there are people who are opportunistic and take advantage of it to make money and to capitalize in some way and to make themselves richer off other people suffering. And I think this is true in all cultures. It's not just our culture. But this whole idea that people who commit crimes are these animals in tank tops going around and taking from us. Well, there's a lot of people who commit crimes who are wearing polo shirts, suits, and things like that. And so it becomes sort of in the surrounding town, surrounding this town that's sort of quit on itself, people start to make a fun game of this going and either stealing stuff or just golfing around the fragments of this town that used to belong to the people that are now marching in the parade. So it was just a way to try to deal with the hypocrisy that is so existent about, you know, it's all right to steal $10 billion, but if you take $200 off someone, then you end up in jail for 10 years. I mean, there's just so many unpunished things that have been done, you know, to our environment and been allowed to go. And often the people that do this are the people in power and have money. So, and I can say that without believing in any particular ideology. It's just in the news every day. People who have money tend to get breaks, and they can do lots of things that may be wrong that people who are on a lower echelon in society, at least economically, can't do. And so, you know, I mean, I think one of the big things when I was a kid was there was a, you know, there would be these things in the news like, you know, infant formula that was sold by American companies to Africa was poison, was not good. And that was in the news all the time, every day when I was like a kid. And I was the kind of kid, my friend was a newspaper. So I could hide behind it. In other words, I could hide my bulk behind it. That was a great thing. But you read a lot of things. And it's like, well, how can it be allowed to sell, you know, infant formula? Well, it wasn't really allowed, but they got away with it until they were caught because it was, you know, people who were doing it or the companies that were doing it had quote unquote reputations that were solid. So, I mean, I think the looters are sort of just an echelon that exists in every society of opportunists that on one hand turn one way and smile and say one thing, on the other hand, do something very different with their actions in terms of how they treat people and how they respect people.
Well, during that same period, this was happening with farm chemicals that were banned in the U.S., but they were selling them overseas. I mean, we see it all the time. My guest is Ben Miller, and we're talking about the parade. Ben, I'm going to guess that this was maybe kind of a hard sell to get published.
Oh, my. I would say, I mean, I think that I every time I'd finish a draft, I would send it out because I thought I had it. And then I would not get any acceptances, and then I would wait, and then I would go back to it, and then I would be happy that it hadn't been taken because I could see how it could be improved. So, yes, it was a very hard sell. And I think that, you know, the ideas of character development that are in this book, the ideas of landscape and the kind of surrealism that's in it, I mean, I think those things have, you know, up and down have their places in literature. But on the whole, it's a rather radical work. And I think that to place it was difficult because you had to find exactly the right place that was fine with with the parameters of the work. And oddly enough, or you know, interestingly enough to me, I mean, the publisher April Gloaming is based in Nashville, Tennessee. They specialize in books that are related to what they call the Southern Holler, or books that are different, that are sort of a cry or a scream of truth from the margins. And I think that it's no, you know, accident that it went for a place like that. I mean, it had gotten close at some places over the years, but and one thing, the whole experience with the book of 40 years at Place and everything, it often just, you know, I've written this in my little book of quotes, you know, sometimes the best thing in the world is when a book doesn't get published. You know, I mean, you have more time with it, have more time to think about it. And this thing of having to have this certain kind of success is too rigid. You've got to think when you're making art about there's many ways a work can succeed before it even appears, and fail even when it appears. So the main thing was me of getting, it was getting the exact text that I wanted, the roundness that I wanted, the sound that I wanted, the textures that I wanted. And it really did take every single one of those years to do it. And I think, too, the vitalness of actually placing it, place the final frame around it. And I think that it's, you know, you can keep on working on it and working on it, but really to find a place to put it helps make those final last tweaks and final last choices about everything, small, you know, one word to larger things about the work.
Ben, you have a lot of death and violence in this book. It's not gratuitous, but it happens. There's a lot of mortality going on, and it's just part of the parade. It's just part of the process. You have a very ingenious way of liquidating people in this book. We'll leave that to readers to discover something about a casket. But that's just, I read that, and I was just like, oh, man. And at one point, Tove, much to our relief, escapes from this community, and he's outside of it. And that's where he meets my favorite peripheral character, some guy named Kerner, or at least one of the Kerners.
Yes, yes. So when the parade started, there were certain people that actually did not want to take a part in the perpetual parade that had no way of supporting itself, really, at least in the beginning. And so there is an ancestor of one of the first people who left the town when the vote was made to have this endless parade. And he's lived out of the family, sort of set up a kind of camp and a kind of where they sort of cultivated the belief with other people who had strayed from the parade that there would someday be an end to it. And there would be a chance again to try to establish a true community that had families in it and where people helped each other and that wasn't so violent. And so Tove walks and walks after the scary thing of leaving the parade and just, you know, evading death a couple times. He meets a couple of eccentrics on the way up the hill and down, but he finally meets Kerner in this valley. And also when he meets Kerner, gigantic ball of tinfoil. And Kerner has to calm himself as a kind of self-care therapy, has been collecting, all the Kerners collect tinfoil, and they just put it on this ball. So there's a huge silver orb in the middle of their camp. And when a fire is lit, it flickers and it looks like almost like an alternative planet. So Kerner is like not really a religious leader, but just someone who hasn't given up faith in humanity and hasn't given up faith, partially because of his ancestry and stories that were passed down to him, but also has a big sweetness about believing that every chair can be repaired, every table can be repaired, and things like that. And of course, that's not true. And the child, as children do, sees through everything. And eventually he sees that this guy is sort of deluding himself, and which is he wants to believe so much in this idea of complete repair. And you know, that's sort of where the book turns at the end. I won't go into it anymore, but yeah, Kerner's was always there in the beginning. And I mean, I guess I'm looking at my desk now and I have like some champagne foil on it. I mean, I don't have a big ball, but it's hard for me to throw away champagne foil because I make collages, so a lot of times I use champagne foil in them, but that's really not the excuse. I just like the feel of it. So I've always been somewhat of a magpie, And I like different shapes of rust. When I was a kid, I would pick up rust and then have this shape on my sill, windowsill, look at it. So I think there's an element of Kerner that is, a collector, as, as well as sort of a kind of spiritual adventurer.
There's a part where Kerner, I believe he's talking to Kerner. And once again, this is not, this is fiction. It's not meant to resemble anything going on in the real world, but this really resonated with me. And you write, quote, "The plague of the others has confused the definition of American to the point where a salute means nothing. We don't need refugee refrains. We need a revolt, lightning bolts. Who are you that you know better than we?" I think George Orwell would be proud of you.
well, that was sort of part of the dialogue that preceded the beginning of the parade, and so everyone's feeling such despair and pain over the lack of possibilities of the town that, you know, there becomes a natural thing, which happens in spasms all across the globe over history, of blaming one set of people or a group of people for the problem. And they're always the other. There's someone outside the group. So, yeah, there's this sort of idea that, to be separate is wrong. And that there's safety in some kind of anonymity that erases identity and becomes a kind of mass individual. And that's a crucial idea that's explored in the book, but also a failed idea, of course, because as I was sort of talking about, earlier, the book came out of my struggle to survive in America as a kid who was from a very difficult situation and on the streets and things like that. And I think, to struggle to stay alive begins with finding a way to declare one's humanity loud and clear so that it pierces that tumult of erasure. And erasure isn't quiet. Erasure is a tumult. Often, it's not this thing of being taken away, and it can be a tumult. A tumult can erase, so people can be erased in front of your very eyes and still be there, in a sense. So, and I think that, without this concentration on finding out who you are, what your possibilities are and potentials are, accepting your flaws, without that, an identity can't be formed, and without that, your humanity suffers. And in a sense can really dwindle and in a sense become close to snuffed out. And when that happens, then anything becomes possible because you don't really have any voice in anything anymore. Mm. You've come to a point of stasis or paralysis, and so you are a tool. And I mean, I think that's the difficulty with group behavior. And certainly as a kid who was ostracized young, I saw like groups, a lot of bad things are coming from groups. I mean, and a lot of scary stuff. And why are people, why is this group coming toward me? Why are they saying this? And they're not that bad. They can't be that bad. But together, when you start to give up part of your humanity in order to fit in and conform, you start to actually become injured as if you had an internal injury, I think. And if it goes on long enough, there is just an awful thing that can happen where your life is essentially gone. So, and that's, the book is, it's a heavy book in some senses. I think there's a lot of absurdity in it because there's a lot of absurdity in every culture now, especially technology driven in this age. But there's also always been a lot of absurdity in lots of different ways with the class structure and how it contorts and doesn't really fit who people really are, the economic structure, how it doesn't fit who people really are. And so many of the characters in the book are just struggling to stay alive. And the way they try to do it is to try to declare their humanity in some small way And I think I certainly relate to that struggle to this very day. And I think there's a lot of Americans that are in that position. And it is, you know, it can be an all-consuming thing to try to hold on to that amidst the losses, the confusion, and the terrors that are natural, whether it's they're coming from aging, whether they're coming from outside, or whatever. I mean, it's always that thing to try to renew and rekindle that flame of seeing, feeling, tasting, loving other people. And it's just, it can never really be regimented, which is what the parade tries to do. And the regimentation to sort of cut losses ends up in putting everyone in a much more difficult situation. And adults, as usual, and I think there's something else that comes into the book, is adults really don't have the answers. I mean, they just get tangled up in these things and can't get out, you know, and it's really up to the kids to see things as they really are, as long as they can, before they get, you know, compromised. And that's been the case, you know, again and again. It's the young people who have the fresher eyes, who are able to see, like, you are really doing it. like, why are you doing that? You know, this is causing this. And I think that's what Tove is struggling to, you know, he's struggling to keep his senses alive on a very base level in the beginning of the book. But then he's also struggling to keep his spirit, as he realizes as the book goes along, and his mind and his ability to love alive and to care about people. He wants to have a life that is about connection. And I think this is where this book, this fictional book, connects to the previous book, Pandemonium Logs, which I worked in telehealth ICU, which is all about connecting to small hospitals and trying to help patients that you can't see and touch really that well. And the sort of how we are divided so often by different things, and it's to come back and get that connection, somehow reconnect the wires, that is just crucial to happiness of any kind, and may even be crucial to the survival of the planet. And so obviously it's not, I don't resolve anything in the book, but what I do is study these themes and what ways are there that we can get around this regimentation? What ways, how can we sing ourselves into better beings, walk ourselves into better beings, eat ourselves into better beings, you know, somehow take what we have to work with, no matter what that is, and find the best little thing and try to make that grow, which in a way is what Kerner does when he grows that entire orb, you know, like an alternative planet that's simmering and silver and new looking.
My guest has been Ben Miller. We've been talking about his first novel, The Parade. This has been Ben's fourth appearance on the program. You can listen to him on the podcast versions of our earlier interviews. And if you want to read about his early life, I would suggest his first book, Riverbend Chronicle, The Junkification of a Boyhood Idol and the Curious Glory of Urban Iowa. It's a great way to start off with Ben's work. And Ben has a book-length visual poem coming out, and we'll look forward to having you back on the program for that, Ben. Thank you, as always, for your time.
Oh, it was such an honor, Vic. You're a radio legend to me, and I look forward to it.
For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis, and you heard about the new book by Ben Miller on a program that has been on the air now since 1994, and we have over 1,000 podcasts archived. You can listen to whenever you want. Just go to wyso.org and search for them, and Ben Miller is in there. And Ben, I got to go. I've got a parade to attend, Ben.
Okay, just don't get on the lead float.
Okay, Ben. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.